Session number 6058, reel 3.
And those were thoroughly tired out and exhausted. So I introduced myself and asked if there was anything I could do, and I was received very thankfully and told to start work, and told what to do. And Dr. Winchester himself was able then to have a bit of a break and a rest. And I carried on with the help of this nursing sister who did the darkroom work, developing films, and being very, very good about it all. And I was thoroughly tired out and worn out myself, of course. But after a few hours, Dr. Winchester arrived, and I was able to find a corner, have a sleep, and I woke up feeling much better. And from there on, we carried on between us and got through as many of the patients as we could. And it was just simply like a production line. I don't know. I really had very little idea of who they were, what they were, or where they were going from here. A lot of them were taken to the operating theatre, where the remaining staff were doing the best they could. Some of them were dispersed, just bandaged up and taken to places where they could be temporarily looked after in the hospital. But it was a very, very chaotic and hard-pressed situation. And it was very obvious that things were getting into a state where we couldn't have carried on for very much longer.
Did the news of the surrender occur whilst you were there?
Yes, the news of the surrender came whilst I was having a bit of a break. I was awakened from a sleep by Dr. Winchester, who said, well, come on, Sergeant, you might as well wake up. He said, I've got a drink here, and he produced a bottle of something. And he said, it's all over. We've just had the news on the radio that General Percival has surrendered to the Japanese. And my impression was of silence when I woke up. The sound of the artillery fire, which had been pretty constant until then, and once I recovered myself, how quiet it was, and there was this sort of tenseness in the atmosphere, and people wondering exactly what was going to happen.
What was your own reaction when you heard the news that we'd surrendered?
Acceptance, I think. It obviously wasn't a surprise, in the sense that it had been pretty obvious for several days that there was nowhere else to go. We had all hoped, of course, that some miracle would happen and that perhaps we could be rescued in some way. But I just felt rather stunned. I don't recall feeling any particular fears or apprehension about the immediate future. It was just a stunned numbness, I suppose. And I thought, well, I remember one. I thought, well, at least we shall be able to get a little bit of sleep, perhaps, and catch up with things a little bit, and get some kind of order out of all this chaos which we've been experiencing.
Did the situation in the hospital improve after the surrender?
The situation in the hospital was a very dramatic change, in fact, because within a very short time the Japanese troops were moving in, and we were told that all the civilian patients had to be evacuated. I don't know where they were to be evacuated to. I seem to remember being told about some empty warehouses or a factory which were not very far away, and that they were all being the casualties were all being taken there in order to make room in the hospital for the Japanese wounded. But from my own experience at the time, it simply consisted of helping with the patients, removing stretchers and so on, trying to do what I could in the way of a bit of first aid and so forth. Most of the nurses had been evacuated. A few had stayed on. There were very few nursing personnel. And the ones who remained were being evacuated with the patients to this new location, which, as I say, I'm not quite sure what or where it was. But there was a stream of ambulances arriving at the hospital. We were loading the patients aboard them, and they were being taken by the ambulances to the new location. And this included everybody, and I recall being very affected by the sight of dozens, scores of very tiny children, often without parents, hurt, wounded, frightened and so on, being crammed into these ambulances and the various forms of transport, and just being taken away with the rest of the patients and to some kind of unknown destination. That was one of the few things I recall which really, even though the time was a little bit traumatic in many ways, I really was affected by the feeling that these children might never see their parents again, that lots of them might die, and that they were going to an unknown destination.
So what happened to you after this evacuation?
Again, I'm from the time point of view, I couldn't say exactly how long this sort of thing took. But at the end of this period, it might have been 2 or 3 days, the remaining army medical personnel were assembled together. And we were put aboard some army trucks, which had turned up from somewhere. And we were taken to some buildings somewhere on the outskirts of Singapore. They had been offices belonging to some government department, as far as I could gather. And this had been converted to a temporary army hospital. There were lots of casualties there. Without exception, they were lying on stretchers on the ground. There were no beds, of course. These were the worst ones, were on stretchers. The ones who were able to sit up or lie on straw palliasses and so on were lying around in the various empty corners and so on. And so we were able to get busy and look after our own casualties again under very, very difficult conditions, because we obviously had no medical equipment, and we were managing with what we'd managed to carry ourselves, and in the very, very makeshift conditions.
Were you under guard?
I never saw any Japanese guards in this particular place. We were, seemed to be entirely on our own, and again, we had no food. We were only we were living on our emergency rations and such stuff as we'd been able to find or take with us. And it didn't last for very long, a few days, I suppose, but it was becoming very desperate, because by this time casualties were dying. The more seriously wounded were in very, very advanced conditions of severe injury and so forth, and there was very little we could do about it. So it was very worrying from many points of view, and we felt pretty helpless, because although there were no guards, we knew jolly well that we were not allowed to move out of that area, so that we couldn't look around to do much about it.
What happened to you at these government offices?
Well, it was from here that we were moved finally to the main prison camp area in Changi, and we took our casualties along with us. There was some transport was provided, And this was my first view of Changi, which again seemed a very, very casual, disorganized sort of situation. I had visions of traditional prison camps and so on. But in fact, there was absolutely nothing. I think the Japanese had strung a few strands of barbed wire around the perimeter of this very large area. And there were no Japanese guards. It seemed that people were left very much to their own devices. And we were told one of the buildings, one of the original barrack blocks, which had been occupied by the British regular army garrison. They were all very badly damaged by bombing and shelling, but one of them had been patched up and was being used as a hospital for the casualties. So we took our people along there and found that there were makeshift arrangements, beds had been put in, and of course there were endless numbers of medical corps doctors and army personnel there. So there was absolutely no problem in having people to take care of them. So we delivered the people that we had with us over to the hospital, and then we had to make shift for ourselves and find a place to sleep and see what the arrangements were for finding food and so on. And, well, as far as possible, a few of us kept together. I found a corner in an annex of one of these bombed out buildings, and we set ourselves up there lying on the ground with our ground sheets and so on. And by this time the Japanese had started to provide a few basic rations. I think we had been living on a few provisions which various people had brought in with them. But I'm not very clear again as to the time element, but at some stage during this period the army cooks were able to set up their soya stoves, mobile kitchens and so forth, and started handing out boiled rice twice a day, which was about the limit of what we had provided by the Japanese. So we had our army canteens, the billikens, about half filled with a scoopful of rice twice a day. And for the remainder, we had to make do with such provisions as the various army units had brought in to the Changi area. And I'd like to say that the organization here did a very good job, because as I saw it, the main provisions and such food as there was, medical supplies and so forth, were funneled into a central receiving area. All the food was stocked there. There wasn't very much, because I don't think any unit arriving there had very much with them in the way of provisions, but what such as there was, and these were things like bully beef and of course medical supplies, army biscuits, and generally sort of emergency rations, at least were put together, and such food as there was fairly distributed to the army and the personnel people in Changi, and everybody got at least something.
Were individuals required to pool any valuable possessions they had, such as food and medical supplies?
I don't know. I suppose that would have been desirable, but I doubt if in the circumstances that individuals would have done that anyway. If a person had a bar of chocolate or a tin of bully beef in his pack, I doubt very much whether he'd have put it into a pool, because as I say, we were several days, maybe a week or 10 days, without anything at all until the Japanese provisions started coming through. And it was very much a case of foraging for ourselves. So if one had a tin of bully beef or a packet of biscuits, I think it would have been eaten long before this organisation did start to operate.
Did individuals have medical supplies of their own?
Various units, again, there wouldn't be very many, but the remnants of the field ambulance company that I was with, of course, we had what was left of our first aid kit. We had the instruments and so forth. I carried quite a number of those in the first aid pack, which I had myself. And such things as these were all put into the central medical supplies, of course, and made use of in the hospital. But as there were not all that many army medical units around at that time, I can't see that there'd be very much in the way of supplies arriving in that way. I think most of the hospital equipment and so on came, in fact, from the Queen Alexandra Hospital. Had been brought out to Changi by staff and personnel from there. Certainly the operating theatre instruments and so on were far too sophisticated to have been used in a mobile army field unit.
Were there any diseases showing themselves at this time?
No, in the very early days I didn't see a great deal of disease. The main concern of the medical units, of course, was to take care of the enormous number of casualties there were. And these were, of course, wounded and so on, a certain amount of sickness. I remember that a lot of the first evidence of disease, if you like, was were the skin diseases, which were endemic in that part of the world anyway. Some horrible examples of ringworm, for instance, and very advanced cases of tinea, athlete's foot, tropical ulcers, this kind of thing, which were a result of the operations up country, the areas in which people had operated, and generally low living standards, I suspect. But it wasn't until a little later that the things such as dysentery and beriberi and malaria started to make any serious inroads.
What was the cure for beriberi?
The thing which impressed me was the medical properties of the product known as Marmite. I don't know how or in what way it got there, but obviously amongst the food supplies and so on, or perhaps the medical supplies, had been a certain amount of this stuff. And the very, very severe cases of beriberi, and they had to be, by this time, admitted to a hospital, and they had to be diagnosed as being in a tertiary stage, often involving cardiac and cerebral symptoms, would be given a few spoonfuls of Marmite, and it was quite remarkable the recovery which most of them made as a result of being given this treatment. People in very, very advanced stages with edema and sometimes almost totally unrecognizable through their limbs and their features and so forth being so swollen and edematous, we could see the water drain out of them and they'd regain their contours and look pretty normal again within a very few days after simply two or three spoonfuls of Marmite. So this was really a lifesaver, and obviously when the time came and it ran out, it would be a very, very serious gap in the medical treatment available.
Can you tell me about the work which you were set on doing in Changi?
Yes, well, initially I was put in charge of or at least an NCO in charge of one of the wards I suppose there'd be about 70 or 80 beds, it consisted of one floor of one of these barrack blocks. The beds were very packed very closely together, of course, and we were generally looking after the wounded and doing the best we could in the way of treatment. As I say, there was no shortage of medical personnel, either in the way of medical officers or NCOs or ward orderlies and so on. But initially, I was on night duty mostly, as NCO and general charge of this particular ward. This went on for a few weeks, but gradually the number of casualties became smaller as the wounded either recovered or died, and the number of medical personnel required to work actively was consequently reduced. And as I wasn't really, I'd never been trained for ward work, and there were people far more qualified than I was in that type of job, I gratefully withdrew and found something else to do, which, well, I was given something else to do, which in the event was a part of the camp policing arrangements. Perhaps I should explain here that having established ourselves in Changi, and by this time we had all acquired or made some kind of accommodation for ourselves, but each army unit was allocated a particular area within the main Changi compound. And by this I mean that, say, the RASC, for instance, were in an area by themselves. Artillery people were generally together. Various infantry units were grouped together. The Australian Army, or the Australian services generally, were also grouped together in another area. And each of these separate areas had been wired off with a gateway through leading into the area next door. And each of these gates had to be policed by the unit responsible for that particular area. Now, in between these locations, there were stretches of empty road or country. And along these stretches, which were not very long, maybe couple of hundred yards, were posted the Japanese sentries. Now, these were between the areas. We didn't see any actual Japanese guards, at least I didn't, or sentries inside the compounds where we lived ourselves. But if a party of people wanted to move from one area to another, for instance, if they wanted to collect food from the central area which was occupied by the RASC and where they had some buildings converted for the storage of the supplies such as we had, and for the Japanese rice, for instance, which was issued daily, parties of men had to go from the various areas along the roads and pass through other areas in order to get to the central food storage the buildings. And this meant going through all the various gates and through the wire and so on. They were given a white flag with a Japanese a symbol on it, which the leader of the party had to carry. They also had Japanese-approved armbands, which they had to wear. And our job when we were policing the gates of the part we occupied was to make sure that the parties proceeding through were equipped with the necessary Japanese authority to move from place to place. So I was NCO in charge of a police detail, which we had to operate on a 24-hour basis on one of these entrances to the medical corps compound.
Why was it necessary to control movements between the different sectors so rigidly?
This was never explained. I suppose it was simply a part of the relatively loose discipline at that time, which was dictated by the Japanese army. As I say, up to that time, apart from the spell at the Civil General Hospital where the Japanese had been supervising the removal of the wounded and so on, I hadn't actually set eyes on a Japanese guard or soldier. And in fact, the guards on the roads between the areas were not Japanese. They were the renegade Sikhs and Punjabis who'd gone over to the Japanese and were set up as guards in Changi. And of course, another thing which dictated by the Japanese was that every individual passing these guards had to either salute or stop. If you were not wearing headgear, you had to stop and bow and then proceed onto the next stage. But that was the only evidence that I saw of the Japs guarding the Changi area at the time. And why these this elaborate arrangement of flags and armbands was operating, I just don't know. Unless it was perhaps part people perhaps planning to escape, if there'd been a mass escape or something like this, perhaps people would have had to move for some distance from place to place to get through the wire and away from Changi. And obviously anyone moving around without outside the prescribed areas would be immediately suspected by the guards. So I think it was perhaps a rather primitive system for preventing escape.